This is The State of Things. I'm Melinda Pencava. For 200 years, from 1715 to 1919, many children in North Carolina were taken from their families and forced into labor. The practice was known as forced apprenticeship, a system that removed children from single mothers. It also provided cheap labor after black slaves were freed after the Civil War, and it was abolished in 1919. The question is, what allowed this system of child labor, of involuntary apprenticeship, to go on for so long here? And have you heard family stories about forced apprenticeships in North Carolina? We welcome your calls. Our number is 1-877-962-9862. Karen Zipf writes about this in her new book, Labor of Innocence, Forced Apprenticeship in North Carolina. She's an assistant professor of history at East Carolina University in Greenville. And Karen Zipf joins us now. Thanks for being with us.
Hello, how are you?
Fine. Well, this is a topic not many people may be familiar with, but I think when people have this picture of child labor in America, it brings up images of children forced to work in factories or fields or coal mines in the early 1900s to support their own families. But what you're describing happening in North Carolina for two centuries is very different from that.
Right, that's right. I wish I could say that I've written a history of child labor. But actually, I've written a history of apprenticeship, which is a segment of child labor. In other words, apprenticeship was one institution that regulated children's labor, where, of course, there have been others like slavery and, you know, sharecropping systems, and, of course, the industrial economy of the 1880s until about the 1930s that we know of as the, you know, the textile mills in North Carolina that predominated throughout the state. But apprenticeship was a unique institution that operated under a strict code of laws called the Apprenticeship Code that was that really began its existence in 1715 as a code of laws. Of course, apprenticeship existed before 1715, but the state began to take control over it about that time and then persisted until 1919.
And the central part of this is that this was not parents offering up their children to learn a skill, live with somebody else who was a master of some type of skill, but you write that this was a case of children being forcibly taken from their parents, and the distinction was that if there was no white man in the house, the children could be taken.
Yes, and that's based upon the understanding of women's status in that period, particularly between 1715 and in the 1880s in particular. Women operated, or women lived, according to a rule which was called coverture. When a woman got married, she really had no rights of her own. All of her identity was subsumed by her husband, as well as her property and her custody rights to her children. A woman was not considered to be the sole guardian or a primary guardian of her children. It was really the father who had control over the children. And so as a secondary guardian, she had certain limited rights, but it was really the father that had rights. And so when that father was absent, or when there was no father in the home, or even if the father was absent for, you know, if the father sort of abandoned the family, but and had not been heard of for a year or more, the county could come in and take those children, presuming that the mother was not able to care for them because she herself was of dependent status, like her children themselves, and then apprentice them to masters in the county, and they generally had to be within that county. So often, the mother might know of the master. She probably did not know him very well, and he was probably of a much higher class standing than she would be. And that master would be able to determine the kind of work that that child would be forced to do. So some children were apprenticed into the crafts. Particularly white boys would be apprenticed into the crafts. And then others would be apprenticed into domestic service. Particularly women were, or young girls were apprenticed as domestic servants. And then many children, both white and black, were apprenticed as farm laborers. And that was probably the main function of apprenticeship, was to put children to work in agriculture.
Was there a time at which point you stopped being an apprentice once you reached a certain age?
That changed a little bit, and sometimes it differed by sex. But generally speaking, apprenticeship would end at the age of 21.
How many families were affected by these forced apprenticeships during the years, you know, that you're describing, the 1700s to 1919?
I never did a full count of all the apprentices in North Carolina. That would be very difficult to do because it's kind of disparate. The records are kind of disparate in that they're at the county level. But I did do some research into counties, seven counties across North Carolina from 1800 to 1860, and I did get a sense of the kind of apprenticeships that were going on in the Civil War period, or the Reconstruction era, when former masters were trying to secure the labor of their former slaves' children. And, you know, I don't think it's, I think you could estimate that somewhere in the neighborhood of 100,000 children between 1715 and 1919 were somehow affected. Now, that, there was some overlap because, you know, some of the children, you know, some of these children were, there might have been some overlap with slavery, that is, and that some of these children might have been enslaved before the Civil War and then were apprenticed afterwards. But I would say that the numbers could be fairly high. I mean, I looked at just a small sampling of indenture contracts, 1,300 across seven counties, and those were only the indenture contracts that existed in those seven counties for that 60 years. And if you were to estimate that there are, you know, 100 counties in North Carolina, and you look at it over a 200-year period, it's a vaster system than I think make claim to in the book. But I would have to say that would be an educated guess.
Sure. What was the underpinning for this idea that these children should be taken?
Well, generally, it had to do with attitudes about mother status. The idea was that women were dependent themselves and did not have the character or the economic, the economic position to take care of their children. Mm-hmm. And so generally, apprenticeship was really a way to keep women from having full control over their children. It was also a way, during some periods of history, particularly between 1826 and 1867, to deprive African-American men of their children as well, free black men of their children, particularly as abolition really begins to heat up in the North, and especially right around the time of Nat Turner's Rebellion in Virginia. You see an increasing paranoia among Southern whites, particularly Southern plantation-owning whites, about the fear of slave rebellion. And a lot of that fear is directed towards free black populations, who they fear are the ones who are going to incite rebellion among the slaves. And apprenticeship was a way to sort of deprive African-American men from having full control over their children, and thus depriving them of a measure of their independence.
So the state would sanction the idea that somebody could come in and take away the children in a household where there was, in an African-American household,
where there was father,
the father and mother both living there.
Right. And generally, the way the law was worded, it said that the state had the right, or the county, had the right to go in and take apprentice a child if the parents were free blacks and not living in a honest and industrious fashion. I think that was even the wording in the code. And so honest and industrious could mean anything it depended on how you might define honest and industrious. So it's a very vague measure. And so, it seems certain that in that period, if someone of upstanding status did not appear, quote, honest and industrious, their children could be taken away just as easily as someone who was not honest and industrious by our standards, I suppose you could say.
Right. We are talking with Karen Zipp, who is the author of Labor of Innocence, Forced Apprenticeship in North Carolina. We're talking about the system that was part of child labor between 1715 and 1919. If you want to join the conversation, our number is 1-877-962-9862. Well, the Civil War ends. Black slaves are freed. But the state of North Carolina still has this policy that lets strangers come in and take a child because there was no white man in the house. And What happened then? Did this get ramped up, I wonder, because there was no longer this source of cheap, non-paid labor that the plantations had with slaves?
Well, that's really very much the ticket there. I mean, when slavery ends, when emancipation goes into effect, and when slavery is abolished in 1865, farmers, planters, have no way to control their labor force, their previous labor force. There's no law in place. There's no, you know, in fact, the Union Army has provided refuge for many former slave communities in places like Princeville up in Edgecombe County, a former refugee camp for former slaves, James City in New Bern, North Carolina. In New Bern, North Carolina itself, the city itself, there are a lot of refugee slaves. And in the Wilmington area, there's a high propensity there. And so, and then... You can imagine, I mean, a lot of these slaves, these former slaves, when the war ends and they have their freedom, they are looking for lost family members. They're going across, they're wandering around the countryside trying to figure out where their child might have been sold to 20 years before, or what happened to their uncle that they remember as a child, or perhaps their husband or wife had been sold in slavery. And so their first concern is not, you know, getting the cotton out of the fields or, you know, bringing in the tobacco or whatever. Their first concern is getting their families back together. And so the planters, their first priority is to try to restore labor productivity and to restore production, because cost, inflation is so high because goods are so scarce in the South after the Civil War. And so planters try a number of labor systems. They try gang labor. They try contract labor, which is facilitated by the Freedmen's Bureau, who are writing some of these contracts, in part working in behalf of the former slaves, and in part sometimes not as, you know, nobly working for the former slaves.
And the Freedmen's Bureau, was that a kind of a clearinghouse for former slaves?
The Freedmen's Bureau actually is a really fascinating institution, the importance of which goes well beyond the scope of this book. Freedmen's Bureau was an institution that was established by the Republicans after the Civil War in order to try to serve as a mediator between former slaves and the white plantation owners and Southern whites generally. And the Freedmen's Bureau came in and established a second court system. In other words, it took over some of the duties of the county courts to the dismay of many Southern whites. And it also adjudicated a lot of cases between whites and blacks. So apprenticeship sort of kind of fell under their purview, especially because the federal government began to claim that purview, although county courts, and many county courts entirely refused to accept the Freedmen's Bureau's legitimacy. But it was an institution that tried to help restore labor conditions, tried to restore some kind of good order for labor to resume, because while the Freedmen's Bureau was trying to operate in behalf of the freedmen, of the freed people, it was also trying to restore some kind of system, some kind of order in the South, mm-hmm. some kind of order that would encourage, you know, productivity in agriculture, because that, of course, was the South's main form of production. So the Freedmen's Bureau often figures into the way the planters are trying to get their free people back into the fields. Gang labor was one. Labor contracts was another. Sharecropping, which really became the predominant form of mode of labor throughout the late 19th and early 20th century, was another way that planters tried to restore control. And sharecropping also was one way that many African Americans preferred over some of these other systems, because it gave them a little bit of independence. But another way, yet another way, that planters were able to control, and certainly probably the most, I would say, egregious way, was through the system of forced apprenticeship. And that's because this system was so akin to slavery in reestablishing those old forms of servitude. Because essentially what apprenticeship was used for after the war was for planters to go and get their former slaves' children, secure their role as masters again, as guardians, in loco parentis was the term, in place of the parent, through the court system, and to legitimately have control over them and take them back to the plantation without consent of the parents.
And so at this time after the Civil War, was it the case that more black children would be apprenticed under the system than white children?
Absolutely. In fact, it was even after 1850, well before the Civil War, that the courts and the legislature are beginning to become a little bit more lenient to white women of white children. The situation's actually a little bit different.
In other words, single white mothers could keep their kids. Yeah.
Right, that's right. So white mothers can keep their white children. Now, it's, like I said, the situation's a little bit different for white mothers who have mixed race children. That is a different story. But they're beginning to get a little bit more lenient towards white women who bear to white mothers, that is, who have white children. And that's between 1850 and about 1867 that the system is really basically used to control African Americans.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You have a section in your book where you write about someone who is very much brought into forced apprenticeship. I mean, this person is tied up. I mean, I was wondering if you might tell us about this and read a little passage there about this person who was forced into apprenticeship.
This is a case of Daniel Bagley, who was an apprentice during the Reconstruction period. He was taken by his master, and I think he's about 20 years old, and he's not quite 21, but he is by our standards an adult. And these records come from federal records, and I think they're facilitated by the Freedmen's Bureau. I don't think I found them in the Freedmen's Bureau records exactly. I think I found them in some Justice Department records. But Daniel Bagley is complaining to the Freedmen's Bureau and to the federal authorities about the injustices of apprenticeship and how he's been treated in apprenticeship. And he testifies that when he was supposed to be working for Bagley, he was told to lock the mules in the stable, and somehow the mules got out. He locked the mules in the stable, but somehow they got out of the stable. And when Richardson, his master, noticed that the mules were wandering around in the rice patch, which makes me conclude this was happening around Wilmington, he hallowed out to me and said if I did not get them out of the patch, he would whip me. I told him I could not help them getting out of the stables, as it was impossible to keep them in. He crossed my hands and tied them behind my back and carried me into a room. He pulled off my coat and he made me sit in a chair where he whipped me with a hoop pole, and then got a double strap about as wide as my two fingers and whipped me some considerable time with it, asking me if I was going to stay until I was 21 and behave myself as I ought. I said I did not know I had misbehaved when the whipping was repeated. And this kind of testimony, I mean, this kind of treatment, the testimony that Bagley is giving, just outraged many of the Freedmen's Bureau agents, because to them, this looks no different than the system of slavery.
So what brought about the change eventually then? Because this idea of apprenticeship was going on until 1919, you write.
Right.
Yeah.
What brought about which change?
Well, what brought about, finally, before we close here, what finally brought an end to the apprenticeship?
Oh, to the system of apprenticeship.
Yeah,
you
yeah.
mean? Well, generally, people began to have a little bit different attitude about children's best interests and the role of mothers in their relationship with their child. Generally, what you see throughout the nation happening is that progressive reformers are beginning to see children and the role of the state a bit differently. They believe that children now should be under the care of their mothers at least for a number of years, and that they should not be, while patriarchal control or the father's control can remain primary, women are gradually getting more rights to their children because there's a concern as to whether or not the children's best interests are always served by being with the father. Mm-hmm. And when you've got this kind of change occurring, you've got this you fundamentally got this sort of erosion of the very basic assumptions of apprenticeship, which assumes that women do not have any right to their children at all because they're of dependent status just like the child.
Right.
And so as mothers are gaining more rights, or at least as people are perceiving mothers as having more responsibility over their children, it's kind of hard to say that they're actually gaining more rights in the 1880s. But people are seeing that they have more responsibility to their children.
Right.
They're actually able to make more claims, and they are able to fight apprenticeship and child custody.
Well, Karen Ziff, we're going to have to end there. The clock's running out on us. Karen Ziff is a professor of history at East Carolina University in Greenville. Her new book is Labor of Innocence.